Welcome, everyone, to episode 419 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we are going to discuss some unfortunate health news for a couple players, and then we're going to turn our attention to the East and whether anyone can stop the Brooklyn Nets from making it to the NBA Finals this year. Before we get into that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we are recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is a guy who was very salty when we signed off last time because he realized belatedly that we missed a pretty major milestone. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
Yeah, look, it's going well. But no, we completely forgot to celebrate our fifth anniversary for this podcast. We apparently launched our first episode back in, we did that in 2016, but on April 3rd. And we just realized after that date, which is kind of embarrassing. We should have definitely made a note of that. But okay, you just had a kid, so you can barely think straight. I'll Correct. Give you that. So that's on me. But 5 years, man, that's insane.
Yeah, and I mean, thank you to all of you who have been with us the whole journey or any part of it. We appreciate all of you tuning in every couple days, and it's been a hell of a time. I'd encourage everyone to go back and listen.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the first episode. I think episode 2 was the one right after Sam Hinkie resigned, and I had just gotten an injection in my back for a herniated disc, so I was like feeling great but also awful at the time, and then also just got hit with that pipe bomb of a news like in the waiting room for that procedure. So yeah, a lot has changed in 5 years.
I remember that. I'm glad you brought that up. I completely forgotten about that initially. That's true. You were like super skeptical about whether or not your back would ever be right again. I remember that. Those were fun days.
Yeah, and back then, the Sixers were an absolute abomination. Now they are currently the number one seed in the East. So,
and the Bulls had the three alphas. So
yeah. That's true. All right, so we'll get to the Sixers and Nets in the East in a minute. We have to start with two pieces of unfortunate news. The first, we spent last episode talking about the West and whether the Lakers were in trouble and, bringing up some of the other potential contenders out there. We've talked a lot about the Denver Nuggets in particular since the trade deadline, since the Aaron Gordon acquisition. They were looking great, looking like bona fide vital title contenders. Unfortunately, Jamal Murray went down with a non-contact knee injury the other day. It looked bad. We just had to hope it was similar to what Embiid had a couple weeks ago, where it looked like he season over, and then it turned out to be a hyperextension only a couple weeks. Unfortunately, we did not get that with him this time. Jamal Murray is out for this season and probably at least a good chunk of next season with a torn ACL. So, obviously thoughts to him and his recovery. Hope it goes well. Mort, what does Murray's injury mean for the Nuggets and their title chances this year?
Oh, it's catastrophic. It really is. I mean, I hate to close any doors because you just never know in this crazy ass league. But but that's just, look at the way he performed in the bubble last year. If it hadn't been for him, how quickly would they have gotten bounced? Obviously, you still have Nikola Jokic there, who is probably going to win the MVP at this rate. But, man, you need so many guys to step up now. Like, Jokic would have to almost average 30 from here on out. Will Barton has to score more. Michael Porter Jr. has to score more. Aaron Gordon has to score more. I mean, what do you do here? Is this just one of those things where you have every role player kind of step up to fill the void? Or do you give the ball more to someone like PJ Dozier and go, hey, you know what? You've been playing well this year, so step into that role and give us everything you've got. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that their second best player is down and out for the rest of this year, presumably a large chunk of next year, and that is going to change the narrative for the Nuggets dramatically so. And it's such a shame because they were looking really good. They were feisty. They had the motivation. It seems like they were just primed to make a deep playoff run. Again, not closing that door, but it's going to be exceedingly difficult now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, Murray is so important to what they do. Obviously, Jokic is the fulcrum of that team, especially offensively, but the chemistry between those two guys in particular, I know Zach Lowe highlighted it in a recent 10 Things column, you know, it's a huge blow to them. You're going to get probably more Monte Morris minutes. I'm guessing he's going to move into the starting lineup. They have Campazzo as well, so they have point guard depth. If that's, you know, the one silver lining to this injury, is it's not like they're just going to be throwing out random bodies and like they don't have a natural replacement for Murray. They do have guys who fill that position. It's just, you're, you know, as much as we love Monte Morris on this podcast, and we do, there is a big step down from Jamal Murray to Monte Morris and yep. so forth. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question. Like, is Michael Porter Jr. ready for that number two scorer role? Because I think that's kind of what he has to fill now. And then, you know, Aaron Gordon hasn't really been a high-volume scorer since arriving in Denver. Very small sample, but whatever. Does he have that in him to take more of an offensive load off of Jokic, off of Michael Porter, off of Monte Morris?
Well, he does. He does. Yeah. I mean, we know he does. Yeah. We saw that in Orlando. It's just a question of, does that work within the makeup of the team?
Right. Right. Yeah. So it just sucks, man. Yeah. I said it last episode that I just hope everyone gets to the playoffs healthy so we could see, you know, the best of every team, because it really did feel like this Nuggets team was on the verge of something special here. And it just, you know, now it, as you said, I don't want to rule anything out. Jokic is playing at such an unbelievable level that, you know, even without him last night, they put a beating on the Heat, I believe. So it's, you know, it's not like there's no chance, but it feels, you know, if they have to go through the gauntlet of Lakers, Clippers, Utah, Phoenix, and play two or three of those teams in a row and then get to the final, just to get to the finals, I should say, it feels pretty insurmountable without Murray.
Yeah. I always have this thought whenever someone goes down with the ACL tear. It's just so fragile when you think about it, like how a whole season can just ride on such a little part of your body, if you catch my drift.
Yeah. I know.
It's just, it brings it back to like the whole spectrum of the NBA, just the insanity of how many players are doing that much of a workload and so few. I mean, all things considered, I know we've seen an uptick in injuries over the past few years, but, you know, in comparison to their workload, so few players are suffering major injuries despite putting such a strain on their body. I mean, the NBA's medical staffs and training staffs, the ones who really keep the players going, I mean, they just deserve so much credit. I mean, it's amazing because, look, had it been you and I think I would have torn my ACL in the first quarter of any game. I'm fairly sure.
100%. Yeah. I know. That's what, like, every time I watch a game and you watch how many times these guys are jumping and landing on their knees and landing in awkward ways, and it's like, how do they not all blow out their knees?
Right.
Like, how is anyone standing at the end of a season? It's really remarkable.
It really is. So that's a testament to the NBA. And also, I'm actually glad to see that so many guys in recent memory have come back from the ACL tear the way that they have. Yeah. It's no longer this death sentence of your career. So that makes me optimistic that Murray can return in a similar fashion. Also helping him is the fact that he's not athletically driven. Like, yeah, sure, once in a while he'll go up there. Maybe that's going to be a little bit limited when he comes back. I don't know. But he's more of a shooter. He's more of a finesse guy. He's someone who, like, negotiates screens and comes in and like, hits floaters and whatnot. I think he'll be fine ultimately. So that's, at the very least, I guess finishing that on a positive note. But no, for this year, it's it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not like he's not John Wall or Russell Westbrook, where like his athleticism is what fuels his greatness. So yes, that's one good way to look at it. Also, you know, he got paid. He's under contract already. He's got the max deal. So
got no the concerns. Bag, man. He got the big bag.
Yeah. So no concerns about like an Isaiah Thomas situation where you have a devastating injury right before your big payday. So that's good.
I've actually heard tales of Isaiah Thomas still waiting around on the corner for a Brink truck.
Brink's truck in sandals. Yeah.
It's not coming. It's not coming back.
No, not quite. I know our friend of the podcast, TJ McBride, has been bringing up this point a lot, but the timing, unfortunate, not just for this year, but assuming he misses a good chunk of next year as well. You know, Michael Porter Jr., he's eligible for an extension this offseason. Otherwise, he'll be a restricted free agent following the 2021-22 season. Aaron Gordon's also heading into the final year of his deal. So this injury not only has ramifications now, but that's going to make it more difficult for the Nuggets to evaluate, you know, is this Jokic, Murray, Porter, Gordon core? Could this be a title contender?
Right.
We, you know, 10 or what, 8-9 games of sample size said yes, but now they're going to have just a lot less time to evaluate that before it's decision time, which just, again, really sucks.
And hell, Jokic is a free agent in 2 years too.
Oh boy.
I mean, no, but I'm saying it like a lot. You just kind of caught it there. It's so many of their guys are up in a really short period of time. So this could have catastrophic consequences all around, or maybe we're simply living off of the surprise right now, and maybe everything falls in line for Denver. I guess we'll see. But right now, I'm glad that they have a chance to smoke some weed up in Colorado right now just to mellow out.
Yeah, amen to that. So the other piece of health news that just came out earlier today, just very unexpectedly, LaMarcus Aldridge is retiring from the NBA after 15 seasons. He announced on Twitter that he played his last game while dealing with an irregular heartbeat. He said later that night, the rhythm got even worse. It really scared him. They got, you know, he told the Nets, they got him checked out. And he understandably just does not want to chance it. And, you know, all power to him, because heart issues are really scary. You do not want to mess around with that. So best wishes to a hell of a player, you know, a guy who is really... I don't think he'd be on the list of anyone's like greatest players of this era, but you know, one of the greatest trailblazer players ever. One of, you know, definitely a guy that I will think of in this late 2000s, early 2010s. Like, he's been an institution, an NBA institution for the past decade and a half. So, kudos to him for one hell of a career, and you know, best wishes to him moving forward.
Completely agreed. Left Block Aldridge really should be his name. That's where his bread and butter was. Mid-range guy, surprisingly good rebounder after the fact, because he was deemed, you know, a poor rebounder for a significant chunk of his early parts of his career, and he became one of the better ones after that. He decided, okay, I'm actually going to make a really strong effort at becoming a good rebounder. Had an 11 rebound year, became a better positional defender. Like, he was somewhat criticized over the first, I want to say, 4 years of his career, but he really flipped that narrative around and became, you know, a star. We're talking about a guy who's, this is, so I was reading his stat line for his career, and I'm a little bit upset on his behalf, because he only needed 49 points to crack 20,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, right? Like, that's bitter. So, but yeah, no, over 19,000, almost 20,000 points, almost 8,500 boards. He's just, like, yeah, steady. Is he a Hall of Famer? That's something we can discuss at some point. I think it's a little bit early to go all the way down into that. But, I mean, you know, you certainly have a lot of guys in the Hall that are worse. I think it's fair to say. But my final thing here about Aldridge is the Nets are going to miss him. He was delivering big time for them. In the five games that he played, he was averaging 13 points, 5 rebounds, 2 blocks, shooting over 50% from the field. He was superbly reliable. losing him now, that's a big loss, man.
So that was my next question, is how much, if at all, does his retirement affect the Nets' chances of getting out of the East this year, winning the title this year? How much of an impact do you see this making?
I actually think it does make them significantly worse. I mean, this isn't a Jamal Murray situation in Denver where you're losing one of your top guys. Like, he was and is a complimentary player, but for someone who steps into that role and can do what he can do, that's a pretty steep decline in terms of what they have to work with now, because now they probably have to go back to DeAndre Jordan a bit more, which I don't think that's ever the answer to anything. Hey, we need more DeAndre Jordan in our life. I don't think that's a good thing. They don't obviously have Jared Allen anymore, so this would be what, DeAndre, it would be Claxton, it would be, I guess, Blake Griffin at the five a little bit. Maybe Alize Johnson, I don't know, but it's... I would much prefer to have Aldridge in there, so it's a loss.
Yeah, I mean, you'll get some small ball Jeff Green, you'll get some very small ball Bruce Brown at the five, so they have options still. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you said it well, it is definitely not Jamal Murray-esque of a loss for them. Like, as long as their big three are all healthy in the playoffs, that's really all that matters, and the supporting cast will shake out however it will. But it is, I do agree that it is a not inconsequential loss. Mm-hmm. I mean, Aldridge definitely had shown some intriguing flashes in his limited time with the Nets, and I think the thing that works in his favor, or that would have worked in his favor, is that he just gave them more optionality. I think it's Daryl Morey's favorite word, so I'm going to steal it from him. But, you know, it just gives you a different lineup look. So with DeAndre Jordan at the center, you know what you're getting. You're going to get a great rebounder, shot blocker, not much offense outside of 3 feet from the basket. Blake Griffin, not what he was athletically anymore. I don't think you can really rely on him as a small ball five all that much. Aldridge could have kind of bridged the gap between the two, where, you know, he can play the five. He's not a high volume 3-point shooter. At least he hasn't been, you know, he never was really at any point in his career, but he can knock that down occasionally, at least more than DeAndre Jordan can or should be shooting threes. But you're still going to get, you know, you could actually plug him at the five, and I think you feel a little better about it than you would Blake Griffin. So I agree, you know, you're probably going to get more Nick Claxton minutes, and honestly, that may not be such a bad thing either, because Claxton has been really good this year. And, you know, I think one of my concerns with this Nets team and with all of these buyout guys and that they're adding is, you know, do they lean more heavily on the, yeah, Aldridge has more playoff experience, he's a veteran, he knows what it's doing, Blake Griffin, same deal. Do they lean on those guys a little bit too much, like to their detriment? So in a funny way, this retirement might force them back into leaning on, again, a Bruce Brown, a Nick Claxton, guys who aren't as old, aren't as experienced, but might give them that jolt of energy that they need. Mm.
I would say so. I like the Clax. Let's put it that way. I think he's energetic. I think he's athletic. I think he brings you something that you may not otherwise have had. He's actually a pretty fine Jared Allen replacement if you look at it through that spectrum as well. But no, I totally agree with you that in terms of Aldridge, he would have bridged that gap. I mean, DeAndre Jordan, I have a fun stat to give you here. His average shot attempt distance is 1.7 feet.
Good.
Yeah, no, that's good. But, I mean, that just shows you that he is limited to within that. So even if you are guarding DeAndre Jordan and he is standing just 5 feet away from the basket, like, he's just not a threat.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the only threat he serves at that point is to set a screen and free up a teammate.
That's it. So, yeah, now I definitely think it's going to be more Jeff Green, Claxton, and maybe some Griffin, but I'm just saying that LaMarcus was a nice security blanket. I think that's a good way to put it, because if everything else fails, you know what you're getting with Aldridge. You know, he may not be an otherworldly defender by any stretch, but he was a big body as well, like 6'11", 250. So he clocked up the paint, and you knew you were getting something offensively. So, yeah, I see this as a significant downgrade, but of course, they still have Kyrie, KD, and Harden, so right. And Joe Harris as well. So I'm not really that concerned overall, but no, it does make them worse. And I think there are Eastern Conference teams out there who are looking at this decision from Aldridge today and going, that sucks, obviously, for him. Mm-hmm. But whew.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, I don't know that Aldridge would have started on a fully healthy Nets team. I think they like DeAndre Jordan with that starting lineup, not only just because he's buddies with KD and Kyrie, but, you know, with KD, Kyrie, Harden, even Joe Harris in the starting lineup, you don't necessarily need a high usage center, especially on offense, starting along those guys. Like, you're wasting touches if you're giving, even if it's LaMarcus and you're giving him those mid-range jumpers that he's very good at. I think we said this an episode or two ago. That's a win every time for the defense. If LaMarcus Aldridge was taking those jumpers instead of Kyrie, Harden, KD, that's a win. Yeah. So, like, you know, DeAndre Jordan serves the purpose of, okay, I'm you don't need to give me touches. I'm just going to set screens, and I will haul in rebounds and dunk balls, and that's it. Or, like, go up for lobs, but I'm not going to get mad if you don't call plays for me. That's fine. But Aldridge, in the second unit, actually could have done really well, because how many teams have a good answer for him coming off the bench?
Not many.
Like, you know, look at, you know, some of the top contenders in the East, like Dwight Howard versus LaMarcus Aldridge or Bobby Portis versus LaMarcus Aldridge. Like, I'm taking Aldridge in both of those matchups.
Oh, well, that's a little bit tougher. I think you're sleeping on Portis a little bit. I think he's had a better season than what we expected out of him, to be honest with you. And I think he's a little bit more spry this year than we've seen in years past, but I catch your drift. Like, they would be more equal in that sense. I think that's fair to say. And just having that spacing component as well coming off the bench, that's also huge. So, I agree with you in terms of being a bench player and someone who can come off, you know, in the second unit and just put points on the board and space the court. Huge loss. I mean, Alize Johnson is probably going to step into those minutes, and he'll bully ball the ever-living hell out of you, which I really appreciate. But not having the spacing in a playoff context, I don't think it makes or breaks them, but I do think it helps them.
Yeah. No. So let's get into the Nets' title chances now, Mort, because ever since they acquired Harden, you know, there were concerns at first of too many guys who need the ball, blah, 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 there's only one ball, whatever. We've quickly seen that the Nets have been very, very good with Harden in the fold. That said, we still have really yet to see the fully healthy Nets. I think the KD, Kyrie, Harden triumvirate have played 7 games together so far. You know, KD was out for a long time with his injury. Now Harden is out 10 days with his. Kyrie's in and out of the lineup for various reasons as well. So all of this analysis that we are about to embark upon is assuming we get to see not a fully healthy Nets team, because, again, they're not going to have Aldridge, they're not going to have Spencer Dinwiddie, barring an absolute miracle. But, you know, let's assume the big three come May 21st or May 22nd, whenever their first playoff game is.
Right.
All three of those guys are on the floor together. You know, we can't bank on them staying healthy throughout the playoffs, but at least, fingers crossed, they will go into the playoffs healthy. Is there anyone in the East right now that you think has a legitimate chance in a 7-game series to beat this team?
Milwaukee.
Only Milwaukee, or Milwaukee's number one?
Milwaukee is number one. No. Don't worry. Your Sixers are still on the list. That's.
Well, I'm just asking.
No, they are. But Milwaukee is my big. I think people are just sleeping on Giannis at this point. I realize that he's out, and that's not helping the narrative. But I also think there's like a waking a sleeping giant element in all of this. He is just so damn good. And Chris Middleton, it feels like people are still sleeping on him just in terms of how good he is. The Drew Holiday upgrade, is that a significant upgrade defensively, offensively? He's just smart. I think defensively that trio matches up better than anyone else in the East against Brooklyn's trio. See, I'm always so close to calling it New Jersey because they started rolling out these old school uniforms that you've seen, like the blue and like the baby blue and white. Like, yeah, just took me back to New Jersey. But that's the best defensive lineup for those. And then, hey, they also have Brook Lopez, who's still in there in the thick of things near the rim, sending away shots. I like that matchup for Milwaukee. Now, not saying they're going to win it, because, look, it's the Brooklyn Nets with those three guys. They can put up 90 points together, just the three of them, if they hit their strides. And how the hell do you stop that? I don't know. And then you have Joe Harris canning open threes. It's not going to be easy. But if someone out there stands a chance and matches up well, I think it's Milwaukee. I think that is the team that is built to stop them, which is kind of ironic because they were actually accumulated first, because the trio in Brooklyn came together after the Drew Holiday trade. So it's just a funny coincidence, but that almost seems tailor-made to try to stop those guys.
Yeah. No, I think the point you make about the Holiday, Middleton, Giannis trio defensively against the Nets big three is super valid. We'll get to Philly in a bit, but that is one of my concerns with that potential matchup. But how would you break it down? Like, I'm assuming Drew is on Kyrie.
Yes.
Would you put Giannis on KD or Giannis on Hart? They're going to all switch interchangeably, but like, who would be their primary assignment?
I got to go KD, or sorry, Giannis on KD. The length is just an issue. While I would prefer Giannis on Harden from an individual perspective, Chris Middleton would just get burned, I think, off of KD. And I'm fully realizing that Middleton is a great defender, but Durant is a 7-footer who has a high release point and arms that could probably reach me from Brooklyn right now if he wanted to. So, I mean, how do you stop that if you're Chris Middleton?
I don't have a good answer to that question.
But how do you stop it if you're Giannis? Well, I don't know if you'd stop it, but you definitely make that shot far more difficult. The length matches up so well. And then here's the thing, and I don't know if this is hot takey whatsoever, because I think this is also one of those things where it's a small sample size. KD has only played 22 games, and he came off not having played an entire year. But I think defensively he's taken a step down just a little bit, which is also fair. Like, he's, what, 33? He's going to be 33 this year, right? I think
somewhere he turns, September.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, okay. So he's 32 now. He's just come off a whole year. He's also been injured this year. Like, I get that his defense is not top tuned like it was in Golden State. But man, if Giannis just smells that out at some point, like, let's not sleep on what Giannis could do to KD on the other end as well.
Right. Yeah, do the Nets have the personnel to do what Miami did to Giannis last year, what Toronto did to Giannis 2 years ago?
No.
Where you build the wall? Like, who's building the wall?
Bruce Brown.
I mean, Bruce Brown and Claxton, I feel better about than some of the guys in the starting lineup.
Oh, I mean, look, I get the whole Bruce Brown is a big Twitter thing right now.
Yeah.
But if Bruce Brown, I can't stop laughing at this idea that 6'4", 6'5" Bruce Brown becomes like the primary wall piece for Giannis Antetokounmpo. My God, he'll get murdered.
It'd be like the 2011 finals when JJ Barea was the LeBron stopper.
Yeah. It'll be super weird. No, I don't think, from an offensive perspective, I think Milwaukee, especially Giannis in that series, would just be able to go absolutely haywire. I think he would be able to just do whatever he wanted to offensively from a scoring perspective. As much as I like the three individual components in Brooklyn, we have to acknowledge there are still defensive concerns. Harden is still primarily a post defender. Okay, great, but who the hell plays the post anymore?
Well, I know one team.
Yeah, sure, we'll get to him, but well, yeah. And he can't stop Embiid. I mean, they're
yeah.
And Kyrie, man, you know what? Let's talk about that because I can't figure his defense out. There are days when I really feel that he is improved, where he reads angles, like is positioning himself well, like defensively on pick and rolls, and you can sort of see there's something clicking. And then he'll turn around a couple nights later, and he will look lost. I've seen the narrative around the web going, "Oh, he's better." Yeah, in some games he is, but overall, where the hell is he as a defender? I can't figure out his defense.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to see. Is it just like a regular season thing where he's just not totally locked in, and then come playoff time when you can focus on one opponent, really dive into the scouting report, like, do you get better efforts out of him, or will that inconsistency still show up on a night-to-night basis? No. It's a fair question, and it's definitely something that, I mean, yeah, like, dating back to the Harden acquisition, other than the, you know, there's only one ball concern, I mean, early on in this Harden iteration of the Nets, their defense was horrific, and you know, it's certainly that's the way to beat them, is just not necessarily outscore them, because they have, or like, well, you have to outscore them to win the game, but not try to outgun them, I should say,
right?
Because you know, if you get into a run and gun thing with them at first to 140, they're probably going to beat you in that way. It's just being efficient with your shot attempts, limiting turnovers, and you know, shooting above 50 overall, shooting, you know, high 30s, low 40s from three. You just don't want to, if you're missing a ton of shots against them, you're done. But if you're, you know, cashing in on the opportunities you have, because you should have some pretty good opportunities against that defense. It's a fair point.
One of the things that I also think is worth mentioning, and I get this is a regular season stat, and sometimes you just have to throw those numbers out of the window after you go into the playoffs. But Milwaukee keeps other teams from going to the line best in the entire NBA. Opponents are only taking 18.1 free throws against them per night, and that is leading the league. Well, what is one of James Harden's primary methods of scoring?
Mm-hmm.
If you can get him to not draw as many fouls in some way, I think that's a pretty big thing. That's a pretty big factor right there. KD as well, for that matter. Now, sometimes individual talent just takes over and then the stats don't matter. But if that percentage holds true, that's a huge, huge boon for Milwaukee going into any playoff series against those guys.
Yeah, that's a great call. And again, I think it would come down to personnel there too, where, you know, other teams may get into more foul trouble against Brooklyn because they don't have the guys to slow down Kyrie or slow down Harden or slow down KD. But if Milwaukee's big three matches up as well with Brooklyn's as we think they do, then they might be able to stay out of foul trouble because they can just defend them. You know, you're not getting into bad spots where Kyrie blows by you and you're either going to get a layup or you got to just foul him to at least make him earn it at the line.
Two more points about Milwaukee, by the way.
Yeah.
They have Bobby Portis and Bryn Forbes coming off the bench. Mm-hmm. Both those guys are shooting very, very, very well from outside. I don't know if that's going to translate to the playoffs, but it seems they have caught an offensive rhythm. And they're also both prime players, by the way. I think they're playing in some of their best basketball in their career so far. Those aren't in insignificant pieces in a playoff context. Those two guys together, if they both catch fire, and Bobby is a good rebounder as well, if those two guys come in and have good games off the bench, they could swing a game.
Yeah.
That matters. Like, having offensive role players who can come in and knock down open shots and just put points on the board, that matters in a playoff context. Then you can give me all the, you know, the switching arguments, the defensive arguments. Oh, I need a 6'9 wing. All of that doesn't mean jack if you don't put points on the board. That's what those two guys can do.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about the bench, actually, because I feel like, especially last year, Milwaukee's depth was one of its biggest selling points, almost to its detriment when it came to the playoffs, because Bud did his normal Bud thing and refused to play Giannis 38-plus minutes until it was too late.
Right.
So this year, Giannis is playing 34, Middleton's 33, Drew's 31, everyone else is still below 30, but it feels like their depth isn't necessarily as strong as it was in recent years. Like, Forbes, Portis, Pat Connaughton, great PJ Tucker is in the mix now as well. After that, I mean, Jeff Teague may get a few minutes in the playoffs, but I don't think they're going to lean on him too heavily. Do you think, like, is this almost like a Moneyball situation where they built the roster as such that you can't trust the guys beyond the seventh or eighth man, so Bud's going to have to play?
No, honestly, I don't hate the depth. I understand. Oh, okay. I mean, I get that last year they had George Hill, and that was part of that whole, oh, he's a great floor spacer, he comes in with steady defense, all that. But this is where I would like to point out that Bobby Portis and Bryn Forbes are actually shooting a very comparable three-point percentage on higher volume, no less, than George Hill. I get you don't get the defense, but now you have two guys who can go off offensively. And I would argue last year, what really killed Milwaukee here and there was the fact that no one else could step up and score and really could get buckets. Say what you will about Bobby Portis, but he will have those games here and there where he just out of nowhere drops 28 and 12. No, but he does. I mean, we have to look at what he's doing right now as well. 11 points, almost 7.5 rebounds in 21 minutes, shooting 52% from the field, 47 from downtown. He is a guy who can come in and just put up points both near the basket, from range. Like, he is essentially what LaMarcus Aldridge was for the Nets. And I think the depth, offensively speaking, is better. Yeah, defensively, they've given up a little bit. They do. And PJ Tucker isn't going to convince me of otherwise. But I like the offensive depth. And I think we're sleeping on that a little bit.
That's fair.
Oh, and Pat Connaughton got better, too.
Yeah. I mean, so did DiVincenzo. Like, the complimentary guys that were there last year, a lot of them have gotten better this year. And I think, you know, the Tucker thing hasn't... he's played four games so far, so we haven't seen a ton out of him yet. But, if we're looking at a Brooklyn series in particular, that's another guy they could throw at KD or just give them a little bit more versatility to mix it up. So if the Nets do go small and Brook Lopez can't stay on the floor for some reason or another, like if, you know, Jeff Green's playing the five, Bruce Brown's playing the five, and they, you know, that proves difficult to keep Brook Lopez guarding someone efficiently, enter PJ Tucker, who has played that small ball five role, you know, a lot within the last year or two especially, and has done pretty well.
I'm a little bit upset with you. Why would you put PJ on KD when he's just spent the last 3.5 years getting to know every move there's in James Harden's book?
That's fair. And size-wise, it actually makes a lot more sense for him to guard Harden, too.
Both are like 6'5", yeah.
Yeah, and, I mean, if nothing else, it's 6 extra fouls on Harden.
That's true.
You know, if Middleton gets into foul trouble early or Giannis gets into foul trouble early, Tucker's a really nice luxury to have against that team.
Also, and I'm not saying that Tucker is in any way a dirty player. That's not what I'm going to go at. but he can pull out the hard fouls here and there.
He's physical.
Yeah. James Harden has had him on his side for 3.5 years. If Tucker goes in and gives up some pretty hard fouls on Harden and stares that dude down, I mean, I'm not going to say that Harden is mentally at that point where it would get into his head, but I'm also not saying that that couldn't be the case. Yeah. I mean, hey, old buddy, old friend, I know every move that you have. I am going to foul the ever-living S out of you for as long as I can because I know what you're coming with. I am going to hack you down because I want this championship ring that you couldn't deliver to us while we were in Houston together.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Just saying.
Any other things on Milwaukee, or do you want to move on to the other big threat in the East to them?
No. The only thing I want to close with Milwaukee is I think we as an NBA community are sleeping on them, and mm-hmm. I probably would advise everyone to wake up.
That is fair. So let's go to Philly since you brought them up as well. We just saw the Nets play the Sixers last night, or a shell of the Nets play the Sixers last night, because both KD and Harden were out, along with Blake Griffin, Aldridge, just half their freaking team. They still only lost by 6. It was 123-117. The Sixers were up a lot in the early fourth quarter. They're up by 20, and then their reserves just choked away a massive lead, and the starters had to come back in to close this thing out. We haven't really seen full-strength Nets versus full-strength Sixers this year, so I think you have to throw out the regular season result. I mean, the Sixers won the series 2-1, which will matter if the two teams finish with the same record. Sixers do have the tiebreak. But what do you think about a potential Sixers-Nets series, Mort? Do you think the Sixers pose a legit threat?
I think inside, yes. I mean, Embiid is going to carve up everything inside. He could have a series where he averaged 40 points. And I'm not even making a joke about that. He could.
No, he had 39 and 33 minutes last night.
He did. And 13 boards. I mean, this could be one of those 2000 Shaq kind of stat lines for him in that series. The question is, can you get reliable offensive contribution out of Ben? And can you also have an efficient Tobias Harris offensively? Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to say yes to both, because Tobias is just better than he was last year. He's much better. I trust him to a much higher degree. I think Ben is coming around a little bit. So I'm hoping that stays true. But you need the offensive production out of those two guys. You cannot rely entirely on Joel and let him kind of push everything down and that opens up for shooters. No, you have to make sure your three key guys are all offensively on the same page and they have to be in attack mode. And then Seth Curry is going to be the X factor here, in my opinion. He is going to be the guy who will be, the Sixers version of Joe Harris, but hopefully a little bit better. I think he needs to be unleashed in such a series where he comes in as that fourth scoring option, just solely as a floor spacer, someone who really stretches out that already somewhat poor Brooklyn defense, and provides Ben Simmons in particular with the necessary space to drive and get to the basket. I want to see Ben Simmons drive to the basket like 20 times per game against the Nets with the intention not of dishing off, but scoring. And in order
to getting fouled.
Right. And to do so, you need to have Seth Curry on the floor spacing the ever-living hell out of that court. And if not him, Shake Milton.
Yeah. So I have a couple questions about the Sixers and in that series. And one was pertaining to Seth Curry in that is he playable? Because he is. But does he have a place in the starting lineup? Knowing that on the season, the Sixers starting lineup has been fantastic. I haven't checked it in the last day or two. But prior to this, prior to the Nets game at least, their starting five had like the fourth best net rating among all lineups that have played at least 250 possessions, and that's according to Cleaning the Glass. So they've been fantastic all year. But is there a place to hide Seth Curry defensively against the Nets?
Bruce Brown?
So, like, let's assume the starting five is Kyrie, Harden, KD,
yeah.
Joe Harris, yeah.
DJ.
I don't care. Yeah, bit sure. Any big. I don't care.
No, then it's got to be Joe. And Joe, here's the thing about Joe, though. He'll put the ball on the floor. He will body you. That's one of the things that we don't really talk a whole lot about when it comes to Joe Harris. We have this tendency as an NBA community to just label him a shooter. But dude will put his body into you. And I think that size disparity could be a problem. That said, even if that's an avenue that they could go to, I just don't think that if you put Seth Curry on Joe Harris, the game plan in Brooklyn is going to go, yeah, okay, so we ISO out for Joe.
Right. No, I don't either. But I mean, Joe Harris can fly off of screens and launch quickly.
Yeah.
And that's a concern, because I think that would be, if Seth Curry is in the starting lineup, like, I think going into a Nets-Sixers series, the Sixers would not break up their starting five. I think the Nets would relentlessly hunt Seth Curry until Doc Rivers made a change.
All right. Well, we could argue this. Shake Milton has better size.
I'm not even saying Shake Milton. I think that's where George Hill comes into play.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, defensively, he's definitely more sound. You know, you don't get over the height advantage there, but you're right. Like, he's still longer. He's got a longer wingspan. He's got quicker feet. Yeah, I don't hate that. I don't hate that. I thought you were going in the direction of Matisse here, but okay.
So that's my other big question, because I agree with you about Embiid. The Nets have absolutely no answer for him. He will average 40 points per game in that series. You are totally right. Not sarcastic. That will happen. The Sixers don't have an answer for Kyrie Irving, other than maybe Matisse.
When have the Sixers had an answer for an offensive-minded point guard, though?
Yeah, exactly. Like, they, I mean, Ben Simmons is an incredible defender, deserving of, you know, I'm not going to say he should be Defensive Player of the Year. He's deserving of the buzz in that race.
Oh, you don't need to say it. Defense. You don't need to say it. Ben says it plenty for you.
I know. But, you know, should be all first team all defense this year. Like, great, great defender, versatile as hell, can defend 1 through 5 legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
But that archetype of guard, the score, like the quick first step guard, Ben is just not, that's not the best way to utilize him. Like, I would put Ben on Harden rather than Ben on Kyrie to start in this series.
Wow, you would put him on Harden? I probably would have put him on KD, actually.
But then I think, like, I don't think Danny Green can get Harden either.
No, he can't. No, I agree with you. I would put Matisse on Harden. But because here's the thing. I we can talk about starting lineups and whatnot, but, I mean, who starts the game isn't that important. Like, the game is 48 minutes long. I probably would put Matisse on Harden and just tell him, lock this guy down to the best of your ability. Don't even focus on getting a shot. I don't even care if you don't see the ball at any point in the game. Just every ounce of energy you have going to James Harden. And then I would put Ben on KD just because of the size. I mean, it's not just the height and the length. Mm-hmm. It's also the weight. So Ben is like 240, I want to say. Mm-hmm. 240, 235, 240, somewhere along those lines. Like that.
I'm not sure what he's listed. Yeah,
no,
240,
but
he's listed.
Right? Yeah, something along those lines at the very. He's big, is my point.
Yeah.
Like, he can body KD. KD is thin man strong, absolutely. But Ben Simmons is big man strong. Like, he obviously has more size and more strength, raw physical strength than KD. So if he can get KD off of those favorite mid-range areas or the block or wherever he wants to go and really force KD into becoming a three-point shooter, which, yes, look, there are no great answer to guarding KD, but if you force him outside the three and you just force him into taking 12, 13 shots from behind the arc, I think you've done what you can. Then you got to play the odds.
Yeah, so I hear you, because I like, the Sixers don't have a great answer. Like how we talked about, Milwaukee has a good answer for Brooklyn's big three on paper. The Sixers do not at all. Like they have good defenders. Ben, Danny Green, Joel Embiid, Matisse coming off the bench, George Hill as well. They have good defenders, but none of them really seem to have that profile of being able to lock any of these guys down, with the possible exception of Ben against either Harden or KD. Right. The reason I put Ben on Harden, twofold. One, we've seen him, especially against Luka this year now, twice. When he's on that type of guard, a bigger body lead playmaker, that's the type of guy he really can mess with.
Yeah.
So I think that's where he can do some damage against Harden. The concern that I know Doc Rivers has is he can't risk Ben getting into foul trouble, and Harden will definitely try to bait him into fouls. So he's got to be smart. But I think that's where he can do the most damage, because I think the Nets are most dangerous with Harden playing that facilitating role. We've talked about this throughout the season where, you know, conventionally Kyrie would be the point guard, Harden would be a shooting guard. They have flipped those roles where, you know, Kyrie focuses primarily on scoring. Harden is the primary facilitator, also is a great scorer as well. But, you know, he is the head of that snake offensively. So if Ben can gum up the works there, then I think you can live with, you know, it might lead to Kyrie getting 30-35 on a given night.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of the three, that's probably the guy you let go. And, you know, you really focus your efforts on trying to slow down Harden and KD however you can.
You know what could be the thing that kills you in the end in this series? It's the amount of one-way players.
Mm-hmm.
Because, so you have Seth, who, from an offensive perspective, is spectacular, or can be spectacular in the right settings. I know he wasn't last night, but he can be. He's a guy who can get super hot and put a lot of points up on the board. Then you have Danny Green, not exactly the most stable or reliable offensive player, and he's also older. Then you have Tobias, greatly improved offensively, defensively, you know, swinging a miss once in a while. Like it's, and sometimes he has good outings. It's really matchup dependent, is my point. Then you go out to the bench. You have Matisse, great defender. Very little offensive game, if anything, to show for. Then you have Furkan Korkmaz, a shooter, an offensive-minded guy, not much of a defender. Again, like that pattern just seems to be repeating itself, and ultimately it just means that you have to constantly substitute offense for defense, offense for defense, offense for defense. Is that going to be your ultimate downfall, is my question.
It's certainly possible. Yeah, I mean, I don't feel good about the Sixers' chances against the Nets. I think you're right to identify the Bucks as the biggest threat to the Nets in the East.
Yeah, because they have two-way guys. All three of their main guys are two-way guys. And also, you guys are missing out on something here, because you will have Joel Embiid guard the opposing center. Joel Embiid is one of the best defensive players in the entire NBA, and you would basically be wasting his defensive presence by having him, you know, soak up a lot of DeAndre Jordan's minutes or whatever, when who's not a threat.
That's the other thing that I would do. If I'm putting Ben on Harden, I'm putting Embiid on KD. Putting Tobias on DeAndre.
Oh, boy. I get what you're coming from, but KD's got handles, man.
I know.
Like, proper handles.
Embiid has good recovery skills.
He does.
Even if KD blows by him, I think. But there's no good answer here.
I'm sorry, but those are the Embiid glasses. KD's strides are very close to Giannis. Like, I agree with you that Embiid is great at recovery, but that is for against like normal NBA players. Kevin Durant, are you kidding? Look, when he gets the step on you, this is why he's been so productive for whoever since 2007 when he came in. It's the stride. There's no way Embiid catches up to that. If he gets the step on Embiid just once, he's blown by him. He's gone, Brian.
Yeah. No, it's certainly possible. I mean, ultimately, with both Milwaukee and Philly, it's not going to be like one guy on one guy. So Tobias would see some time on KD.
Right.
Simmons would see some time on KD. I don't think Matisse should. I think Matisse would have to go between Kyrie and Harden. I don't think he's tall enough to really do anything against KD. But, like, you know, multiple guys will get that assignment. But I certainly wouldn't shy away from. You're right. Like, having stationing Embiid against DeAndre Jordan is a waste of his defensive potential. Mm-hmm. And if, I mean, they're not playing him in drop coverage this year as much as they did last year, which is good because right. the Nets would just absolutely pick them apart with that. The other concern that we saw last night in particular, the Sixers' half-court defense is really good. Their transition defense is really bad. Mm-hmm. Like, every time the Nets pushed after a missed shot, and it seemed like they just generated something easy. So, I mean, that's something the Sixers might be able to clean up in these last 20 or whatever, 17 games of the regular season, or, you know, once the playoffs begin, maybe they... That's just such a focus for them that they put more effort into getting back in transition. Joel Embiid stops complaining every time he doesn't get a foul called. But it's, you know, it clearly it was the Nets strategy last night. And I think, it, you know, Doc was saying, like, that's how I think they would attack us in the playoffs as well.
I was thinking, let's try to reverse engineer this from Brooklyn's point of view. Because I think the X factor to this series might be Tobias Harris. Mm-hmm. So if you're growing into the series, if you're Brooklyn, obviously you know that Embiid is going to get his. Like, it doesn't matter who you put on him. If you, you can right. put, even if you put KD on him, like that, there's like what a 60-pound difference.
Yeah.
Like so. you can't do that. Like yeah. Embiid would literally break him in half. Okay, you can put Claxton on him. Claxton is listed at 215. That's even less. Than KD. That's also, that's like, there's just no final answer there. That you just got to live with the fact that when it comes to Joel Embiid, you're going to lose that matchup. So yeah. who's your best defender? Even though he's, in my opinion, taking a step down a little bit this year, I still think it's Durant.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you look at as being, outside of Embiid, the toughest offensive cover? It's got to be
Definitely Tobias.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So, okay. So that's KD on Tobias. And if you can go at Harden, this is this boils back to my original point. If Ben Simmons is timid in that series, Bri, you're done. Like from game one, if he's not aggressive to an extent that we haven't seen him before, you're gone. I mean, you won't stand a chance. This boils down to Ben Simmons stepping into the limelight and becoming the offensive dynamo that he can be. It all boils down to Ben, regardless of how we look at this.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'm, again, depending on what this, if we're assuming just same starting five as what they've got currently,
mm-hmm.
I would probably put Harden on Ben. And I would try to bait Ben into posting up because I think that's where Harden is strongest defensively.
Ooh, it would be a gamble because at the same time, Ben just has such a size advantage. And this is mm-hmm. where him not shooting... I get it. Philly fans, you can murder me for bringing it up once again. But this is where him not shooting is a problem. If he was a three-point shooter at 6'10", he would be able to shoot over that, you know, 6'5" Harden.
Not like, even, I mean, forget about three-pointers. Like, even if he could take a mid-range jumper.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because he has come up with some half-court counters. He has gotten better with these hook shots, like post-up hook shots. Right. But you said it well. Harden's a good post defender. He's got the size, like, weight heft. Chest size to, you know, at least stand his ground against Ben. And it's similar to what I was saying about Aldridge earlier. Like if you are getting a LaMarcus Aldridge 15-foot shot, you're happy if you're the opponent.
Yeah.
If you're the Nets and you're getting Ben Simmons to take a contested hook shot over James Harden, even though he's got the height advantage, you're happy because that's not Tobias Harris and it's not Joel Embiid.
I think the Sixers need to come up with something that frees up Tobias.
Mm-hmm.
That is because let's say Ben isn't responding. Let's say he's passive again, and I'm really not trying to crab on Ben Simmons. I'm really not, but it is. I think it's fair to say that has been a pattern that we have seen from him, that he can sort of just dive into a passiveness all on his own accord. I think that is fair to say. If that happens, you need to somehow, some way, you know, get Tobias off of KD so he can go against weaker defenders.
Yeah.
That probably means that you need more on the ball chances for Tobias, which I'm not crazy about him running pick and rolls. I'm not, but you may have to resort to that kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... I'm glad we talked this through, because now I feel even worse about this.
I mean, there is a path. There is a path.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just, so many things have to go right.
Yeah.
And Ben Simmons would basically have to become a type of player that we haven't really seen before.
And, I mean, I'll say this much. You know, these three teams are competing for Milwaukee, Brooklyn, Philly, competing for the number one seed in the East. The number one seed means you only have to go through one of these teams instead of two. Because, you know, they've carved out such a big lead at this point. Like, Milwaukee's 4.5 games up on Atlanta for the four seed. Like, they're going to finish 1-2-3 in some order. I think for Philly in particular, like, if any team of those three needs the one seed, it's Philly. Like, if they don't get the one seed, they're not getting out of the East.
That is a fair point. That could absolutely be very, very relevant for them moving forward. Just one final note on Philly. And that's just to wrap it up with Ben also. I think he's coming alive a little bit more. But overall, this season, I think, has been just for him and what we kind of expected out of him offensively. I think it's been just a little bit disappointing. I thought he was going to be more of an offensive presence. Even if, like, forget about the shooting. Screw the shooting. That's not even that. I just... We've talked about you know, for seeing him increase his shot attempts for 4 years now. He's at the lowest of his career. Whenever I watch him play, it seems like he has more games. And granted, I don't watch every Philly game. There's only so much time in the day. But I am seeing more Philly games where he is, you know, checked out a little bit compared to last year where he was a little bit more aggressive and he had a few of those... games that he kind of tied together where he kind of wanted to prove a point. Mm-hmm. What is happening here is, has he just settled into that whole, well, Embiid is going to run everything and I'm just going to facilitate, play defense. I'm not even going to think about a shot unless it's wide open. I mean, what are we looking at here? Because his efficiency is also down. Talk me through it here. What is going on?
It's been like probably 3 or 4 different chunks of the season is the best way. Early on, I agree. He was off to a slow start. Prior to the All-Star break, he really started to pick it up. Coming out of the All-Star break, another slump. And then the last couple games, he's really started to pick it up again.
Yeah.
So I don't have a good answer. Like, it's, you know, whereas Embiid has just been consistently dominant all season, you're still not quite sure what you're getting out of Ben on any given night. It's not always a night-to-night thing. It feels like more like a 3-week chunk where he's really good and then a 3-week chunk where he's taking a backseat. But yeah, I mean, that's been a focus of the coaching staff all year, is they want him to be consistently aggressive. They want him to be driving. They want him to be trying to draw contact. They don't want him to shy away from contact as he has done in years past.
And, right.
You know, part of that is because he's not a great free throw shooter, but, you know, that's not the only advantage to drawing fouls. You get the opposing team in foul trouble as well. You get into the bonus more quickly. There are a number of reasons to draw fouls, even if you're only going to hit 1 or 2 from the line every time.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, he's going to determine how far they go this year. Like, you know what you're getting out of Embiid. What version of Ben Simmons shows up in a Bucks series or a Nets series is going to ultimately determine whether Philly advances or does not.
Because what I'm seeing from him is 21 games of below 10 shot attempts.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that should never happen for him. He is so good, man. I mean, when he's aggressive, he goes up a tier, like maybe even 2 tiers. When he is fully aggressive, he is one of the most influential two-way presences in the entire NBA, and I don't even care about positions. So to me, it's like you're just leaving so much talent, production, game planning in the way as well on the table by not having him aggressive. And I understand the Phillies coaching staff can't just say, hey, go out and get 42 like you did in Utah every single game. Like, I get that. But, man, going into the playoffs with championships aspirations and all that, I mean, he has to understand that this is his time, right?
Mm-hmm. You would think.
Yeah. I get that this is the fourth year that I'm still bringing up Ben as not a major concern. Well, maybe a little bit of concern. But I just think it's still relevant somehow. And I'm disappointed that it is. Because clearly he's an all-star caliber player. Clearly he's one of the best defenders in the entire NBA. He's a phenomenal rebounder, phenomenal passer. Why not use that entire package that he has to just go in and say to himself, I need 15 shot attempts minimum every single
game. Yeah. So let's wrap up more, because, you know, obviously the Nets or the Sixers and Bucks are the top threats to the Nets.
Okay.
Is anyone else in the East even a remote threat?
No. Should we end the podcast?
You're not buying a Boston resurgence.
I'm actually kidding. I'm kidding a little bit. I actually think Atlanta could be a little bit fun here.
Oh, okay. No,
so here's the thing. This is like all offense.
Yeah, sure.
But they just have so many bodies, and it really boils down to health. Like, that's just priority numero uno. Guys have to be healthy, otherwise this won't fly. But they can just keep throwing double-digit scores at guys in Brooklyn. Like, Trey's going to, you know, be between 25 and 30. DeAndre Hunter can come in there and score between 15 and 20. Kevin Huerter can get hot. John Collins obviously can go for 20. Even Clint Capela can give you 15 and 15. Cam Reddish, assuming he's not superbly inefficient as right now, can get into the action, play solid defense, get some three-pointers going. Bogdanović out of nowhere can drain like 5 or 6 threes any given night. So can Gallo. They have Lou Williams now. I mean, Tony Snell is maybe not ever going to miss a free throw ever again while he's shooting 57% from downtown. I mean, they just have so many offensive weapons. And then they also have, oh, right, Onyeka Okongwu from the bench who can also help clean up. I just kind of like the fact that they have so many guys at their disposal. Maybe that's just enough to overwhelm Brooklyn from the bench. Maybe, you know, the top three guys in Brooklyn are going to be outscoring most of those guys. But if you just keep throwing in bodies who can put up points and they consistently outscore the bench, if they consistently outscore the remaining two starters, could they have a fighting chance?
Well, I mean, they have very quietly, since Nate McMillan took over, they're 16-5.
I know.
Now, part of their slow start to the season was health. You know, they had a lot of, like, basically all of the guys they brought in this offseason were hurt at some point.
Right.
And now, you know, they're starting to get some of those guys back. So that's helping matters. But yeah, it's a good shout. I don't know that I could see the Hawks. Like, I wouldn't pick them definitely, but like, is there a world, if you ran a computer simulation 100 times,
yeah,
is there a world where the Hawks win like 5 of them? Sure.
That is the best way to describe that situation. Yes. And I think just having that many scores, that just gives you so many different variables. So that's a good way of putting it. But yeah, I think they could be interesting. Under normal circumstances, I probably would have said Boston too. But you know what? I mean, I'm sorry. I know they're on a bit of a hot streak now, and they've played better over the past 2 weeks, which good for them. But they have just been so inconsistent all year long. A two-week stretch is not going to turn me into a believer all of a sudden. I still need to see more.
I hear you there. And I mean, this might just be my broken Philly brain, like, refusing to bury them until they're absolutely dead. But if we're going back to what we said about Milwaukee matching up pretty well.
Yeah.
I mean, they have Tatum, Brown, Marcus Smart. It's a pretty decent assortment to throw at Kyrie and Harden in particular.
It is. It absolutely is. I think there is some components there, and offensively, they would have Evan Fournier and Kemba Walker who could really come in and assist them. I think not having Daniel Tice is a pretty big loss here. That's not a criticism of Robert Williams, who I think has been a lot better. And finally they gave him a chance. I was shouting him out months ago, saying he should get more minutes, and I'm really glad that that's finally coming true. But Tice does give you a spacing element that Robert Williams doesn't. He's probably better at switching defensively because he's a very agile 6'8", 250. So there are some components there that I would miss if I was Boston. But yeah, I don't know. I just think there are so many winnable games this year that just gotten out of their grasp for whatever reason, and they have looked discombobulated a lot. Now, if this two-week stretch that they've gone through is real, that obviously changes the picture, but I would not be doing my job here if I was like, oh yeah, 2 weeks, that's going to erase the entire whatever they did over the rest of the season. Like, no, I can't do that. I'm not there. I need to see more.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. Miami, I'm surprised you didn't mention them first.
Defensively, they have a capability. I just wonder offensively, man. I wonder if they have enough offense. They definitely don't have a whole lot of floor spacing. They're also one of the worst three-point shooting teams in the entire league. I love them defensively. I really do. They're on a string. They can switch everything. Jimmy Butler is a superstar. Bam Adebayo is also more or less becoming a superstar. But outside of that, it's a lot of slashers and drivers. And obviously Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero can stretch the floor, but outside of that, who else is there to really space it? I mean, can you play Kendrick Nunn extended minutes in the playoffs when you also have to give minutes to Victor Oladipo and Goran Dragic? What about Trevor Ariza, Iggy? I don't know. I hear you. Like, just in terms of what they did last year, and defensively, they certainly can do some damage. But like you said at the top of the show, in order to win a game, you need to outscore your opponent.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if I trust Miami's offensive enough to say, yeah, sure. Also worth noting, they're one of the worst offensive rebounding teams in the NBA and rebounding teams overall. I don't think that's going to help matters, because if you really have to punish Brooklyn, you do so with size, rebounding in order to get additional possessions. Do they have that aspect?
Yeah, that would be Bam against DeAndre in particular, but like, can Bam outmuscle DeAndre Jordan on the glass for an entire series?
I think he could, but even then. So let's say Bam heavily wins that matchup, okay? Then what? Let's say Jimmy is on Kyrie or Harden. So I've gone on record as saying I think Jimmy Butler, in totality, is a better basketball player than James Harden, based on the fact that his defense is so freaking good, and his offense, while still a long way from Harden's, it's just not, the disparity is just not that great. But that said, he is obviously not the same self-creator that Harden is, by a long shot. So even if you get the best out of Jimmy, even if you get the best out of Bam, okay, you're not going to get a ton of offense from those two. Like, collectively, right now in the season, they're averaging 40 points per game. Look at the trio in Brooklyn. Granted, they only played together for 7 games, but they can all put up 25.
Yeah.
Where is Miami going to find, you know, that third scoring? Tyler Hero's 15 points is nice. That's not going to cut it.
I mean, in theory, it would be Oladipo, but he's only played 4 games, and now he's out already with an injury. So
yeah, and he's just not a great scorer, too.
Yeah, not hyper-efficient by any means.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you can't confidently predict that Victor Oladipo is going to be healthy throughout a playoff series or even heading into the playoffs. So I think that concern is fair. I mean, I think what Miami did last year will be, you know, in the back of everyone's minds as we're looking ahead to the playoffs. And I think you can make a case for them as the fourth best team in the East, along with, I think it's one of Atlanta, Boston, Miami is the fourth best team, with all due respect to the Knicks. You know, outside of those three, like, I don't think the Knicks have a real chance. I don't think Charlotte has a real chance. No. You know, anyone in the play-in mix, like Indiana, Chicago, Toronto, Washington, no chance as hell. So it's, you know, one of those three. But again, this is where the one seed is really important. You know, if you're the two and you have to go through both of the Nets and the Bucks, or the Sixers and the Bucks, or the Sixers and the Nets, whereas the one seed, like, there's a chance right now the one seed would get Charlotte in the first round, depending on how the play-in goes. But, you know, just 1-8 would be Philly versus Charlotte, and then Philly versus Atlanta or Boston instead of Brooklyn or Milwaukee in the second round.
Right.
And that, like, that could have implications for the conference finals as well. Because if, you know, if Philly gets Boston in the second round and just Joel Embiid pulverizes them for four games, whereas a Nets-Bucks series goes 6 or 7, the starters have to play 38-plus minutes a night. Bud actually plays Giannis more than 40 minutes in a game for the first time ever. You know, like, they might get a little bit fatigued by the time the conference finals get here, whereas, you know, the one seed might have just had a cakewalk to that spot. So it's just, that's the thing I'm watching most in the East right now, aside from this play-in mess, which is just hilarious at this point. Who's going to win that battle for the number one? Because I think that's going to go a long way toward determining if any team can stop Brooklyn this year.
We're forgetting actually one team that could stop Brooklyn.
Who?
Brooklyn.
Fair. That is fair.
We all made our jokes before Harden got there, saying, oh, he wants to go to Brooklyn when he made this trade demand. You know, that's drama incoming.
Mm-hmm.
There's still season to go, man.
Yeah. I mean, who's this? When, if they're down 3-2 in a series, who knows?
I'm just right. That's what I'm saying. If their backs are against the wall at some point, maybe Brooklyn becomes their own worst enemy. I'm not going to sit here and rule it out.
Yeah.
But until then, at the very least, I'm going Milwaukee. I'm sticking with the Milwaukee Bucks theme of that, as I did last season, and I make it Budenholzer because of that. But I just love their makeup. And something I didn't even mention at the Milwaukee thing as well, Drew Holiday matched up against Kyrie, he can body Kyrie into oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not undersell the physicality of Drew Holiday.
Well, on your Nets point, too, I mean, this is where them only playing 7 games with the big three so far, like, yes, you respect the hell out of all of their individual talent, but they just haven't had a ton of time to develop chemistry. So, you know, once we get into the playoffs, again, hopefully they're healthy and maybe they spend that first round series just, like, figuring out how to play with one another. But, you know, especially for a team like Milwaukee that's had continuity with most of these main pieces across multiple seasons, could that be a factor in a late game situation or late in a series? Like, could that familiarity with one another, are they going to be on autopilot? Whereas the Nets are going to have to be, you know, like, they just throw away a turnover because they think a guy's cutting here and he's cutting somewhere else. It's, I don't know.
Could you just imagine Kyrie and Durant, like, getting some of their last shots? James Harden will be agitated, and Durant and Kyrie would go, yeah, look, champions get the last shot.
Oh,
if a quote like that came out in the middle of the playoffs, I would laugh my ass off. It would be fantastic.
Oh my god, I would love it, but then I would also hate that would just fuel First Take for like 3 weeks, and I would have to retire from this industry.
That's true. That's true. But no, but I'm just saying that could be like a subplot too, right?
Yeah.
Like Harden never having been in the finals and then Kyrie and KD like having won championships might have this opinion that no, let, like we've been there, we've reached the mountaintop. Maybe James, maybe you just sit in the corner for a couple minutes. Let's us take care of that. Which I don't think is going to go over well, honestly. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all of them check their egos at the door and they just roll through. Who knows?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. All right, well, that is a good place for us to wrap up. So thank you all, as always, for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with the other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Take care, man.
Thank you. I got the J&J vaccine on Sunday, so if I die in 2 weeks, you'll know why.
Nice. Okay. Well, yeah. So is this one of those times I should break protocol and then just say don't die
again? You might have to this time, yeah.
All right. Well, don't die, buddy.
Thank you.